Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Pharma Talk Radio, brought to you by the Conference Forum. I'm Valerie Bowling, the producer of the program, and I'm pleased to bring you Clinical Air, episode number 5, Applications for Mobile Sensors in Clinical Research, or I should say Mobile and Sensors in Clinical Research. With me is our host, Craig Lipset, Head of Clinical Innovation, R&D at Pfizer, and I will let Craig take over to tell you more about today's show and who our guests are. So hello, Craig, and welcome.
Hello, Val, and thank you, and welcome, everybody, to Clinical Air, episode 5. I'm Craig Lipset, and as Val mentioned, I do work at Pfizer by day, but the opinions you'll hear expressed do not necessarily represent those of the employer. Broadcasting today from a snowy New York, and that snow is getting in the way of a really fun event that I was looking forward to seeing my two guests today live in person at, but we're going to have to make do with that by the phone today. Well, today's topic is going to be around mobile, and that was themed to coincide with a fantastic event going on in D.C. this week, the mHealth Summit, put together originally by the Foundation for the NIH and now being run by HIMSS. And my two guests are very close to that space, so I'd like to welcome Abby Steele and Tim Davis. Welcome to the show. So just by way of introduction, Abby, Vice President at UBC, an Express Scripts company. Can you share a little bit, Abby, about what you work on over at UBC?
Sure, thank you, Craig. I have a really fun job here at UBC. I get to work on a variety of projects that are all really directed at patient initiatives. And I support a number of our innovation projects and mobile projects and internet-based and social media-based opportunities to work with pharmaceutical companies, both on the clinical trial side and the commercial side of the business, to help bring new approaches and new models for our pharmaceutical clients to run their programs and to think about how they can look at patients differently and how to incorporate more patient-centric opportunities into the programs and product initiatives that they're doing.
And Abby, some of that covers clinical trials, but most of it, it sounds like, goes well beyond clinical trials, really across that whole pharma continuum.
Yes, I mean, all the way from phase two trials through a drug's maturity and even when a drug has generic competition. So we're looking at what does a pharmaceutical company need to be thinking about as they design and develop their clinical development programs, thinking about launch, thinking about all the stakeholders, payers, prescribers, caregivers and the patients, and reimbursement issues, patient assistance program issues, and really focus post-launch on adherence and support and education for the patients.
You know, Abby, I love talking to people who feel they have the most fun job in the industry, generally because I thought I had the most fun job in the industry. So tell me, how does one get the most fun job in the industry? What was the path that led you to where you are right now at UBC? How did you land in such a position that you can really enjoy everything you're doing there right now?
Well, you know, it's funny. I always think a lot about my career, and it wasn't until just recently, a couple weeks ago, I was at the Healthcare Business Women's Association annual meeting, and somebody got up and spoke and described their career for the past 25 years, and they said that when they really think about their job and the variety of responsibilities they've had, they really have been the intrapreneur within their organization. And I sat there and thought, well, that's me. That's what I've gotten the opportunity to be. And I started my career 23 years ago at Sanofi and got to work on a variety of projects on the commercial side in marketing and public relations. And then I went to Parexel, and went and did a deep dive into clinical trials and clinical development and got to help start up the patient-directed initiatives and patient recruitment area within PAR-XL. And then I went to the dark side and went to a startup and spent a number of years in drug safety and epidemiology and risk management and technology. And that's when I really got my first dose of technology and got to help experiment and explore and do different things there. And when I came to UBC almost 9 years ago, I was brought in really with no real job description. It was really to help build the organization and try to bring some of my knowledge in the commercial, the clinical, and the safety space and bring it all together and think about how we could help grow the company. So I've been very fortunate to get to work in all these different areas and really never have much of a true job description along the way and help kind of create that. So I think I beat you, Craig, in having the most fun job. I have to say that.
All right. I'm going to take that challenge now. by the way, I mean, good fortune comes to the well-prepared. It certainly sounds like a certain level of comfort with ambiguity helps create some of those opportunities along the way. But, you know, there's going to be a very interesting theme. I'm just realizing, hearing your introduction, this may be the first show we've had where all three folks on the line are part people. So we may have to trace something back to Joe von Rickenbach at the end of the show. And I'm going to use that to segue to our other guest, Tim Davis, the founder and CEO of Exco In Touch. Welcome, Tim.
Hi, Craig. Thanks. Delighted to be here.
So, Tim, I don't know if you know this, but you were actually the first joined Pfizer. I had been at Pfizer for about 5 minutes, and my boss at the time said to me, go jump in this meeting. Some guy's going to come in. He's going to talk about SM short message codes and throwing them up on some pharma ads. Go see what he has to say. And that was you.
Wow. I had no idea.
So you've been at this for a while
now. You're still
talking
to me as well.
So tell us, for the folks that haven't had a chance to run into you yet, Tim, talk to the folks about what kind of work you're doing today.
Certainly. Thanks, Craig. So I'm really fortunate as well, I think, in terms of sort of great jobs and the fact that I'm really delighted to lead a very dedicated team of around 60 people now at Exco In Touch who provide patient engagement solutions, very similar to Abby, I suppose, as well, both clinically and commercially. And originally, one of the things we used to do when I started the business in 2004 was, at the time, mobile phones were quite popular, I would say, particularly in Europe and in Asia Pac, and we were doing a lot of SMS text messaging services using short codes with advertising for things like patient recruitment services, and on the commercial side, sort of very simple refill reminder services, disease education awareness kind of things as well. But obviously that's as the technology has changed, that really has transformed what we are able to offer our client base today. And it ranges obviously from more interactive services, more dynamic content, which is fed through mobile applications, right through to something I'm sure we'll talk about later today around bringing in and tallying up, I think, the subjective data which comes in from the patient and to the more objective analysis, which is from medical devices as well. So that's really what we're about as a business. We're really enjoying where the market is going and helping to set that that destination.
So, Tim, I couldn't help but flipping through your LinkedIn profile, and I saw PAR-XL there along with other pieces of background. What was the pathway that led you to appreciating this as being an opportunity way back in 2004? What work had you been doing in terms of seeing some pain spots along the way?
Sure. I mean, as I say, yeah, I started my career in clinical research with PAR-XL as a data manager, as so many of us have had some experience in the CRO lifestyle, as it's often described. And then joined Procter & Gamble and was there for 5 or 6 years. And P&G Pharmaceuticals was a really interesting business, I think, in the sense that obviously it was a massive consumer company and it had a small or relatively small interest in pharmaceuticals. And it was kind of a pet project for them. So when we were doing clinical trials, we were able to try new stuff out. And we were a small organization, so we were always outsourcing. Perhaps a little bit ahead of what now is, you know, very much a common trend in large pharma, I suppose. So we were always the majority of the, I guess, the sort of heavy lifting of clinical research was outsourced to CROs, and then internally, as sort of technical innovators, we were allowed to try things out. So we ran the first sort of pilot European EDC trial within Procter & Gamble Pharmaceuticals, and then we looked at patient-facing assessments for things like osteoarthritis, and we were using what were essentially very early versions of netbooks with kind of styluses on, rather than getting poor nurses to have to measure on VAS scales how long these pencil marks were and stuff like that. Did that for a while, then joined a company called CRF Box, now called CRF Health, around the patient diary stuff, and it was really from there that I realized that you know, conceptually, that idea of removing paper from patients and ensuring that they were entering data at the right time and we were getting clean and accurate data was just perfect. It was such a great idea. But it felt to me that giving patients something else, giving them something else to learn, to charge, to do, didn't quite fit right. And so really, in 2004, I was actually having a drink with my co-founder, actually. Great ideas for businesses always start in the pub, I always say. And we thought, well, what's the platform? What's the lowest common denominator of technology? And we looked around this bar in London. And obviously, maybe it's because you could say a lot of Londoners are quite unfriendly, but most of them were looking at their mobile phones. And we thought, well, maybe it's that. And that's what gave us the idea, and we both finished our day jobs and started up Exco In Touch. And it was really around originally feature phones, Nokia phones, as they were, you know, the predominant provider there, and doing something, you know, simplistic, which, you know, is simple text messaging, and and the rest, as I say, is history.
That's all it takes. Let's use that as a bit of a segue. Then I'm curious, and I'll start with you, Tim. How would you describe the current state of mobile and trials today? Where do you see mobile to have made its mark and to be well instantiated?
That's a good one, actually. I suppose it's it probably depends on how you would define mobile, I suppose. But I think from our experience with our customer base, it seems to be that at the moment it is predominantly patient-facing technologies that are being influenced by mobile. There are some physician services that are available, but that seems to be still either driven from a tablet or from a desktop, as they're usually behind the desk, I suppose, doing the diagnosis and running the clinical trial. But the area for growth we see is around this term, which has become more popular, I think, over recent years, around patient engagement. And obviously that can mean a variety of different things. And it's where we started as, I suppose, the pioneers in this space, was around what was called patient retention. So getting people to the clinic at the right time in the fasted state. I don't think people like the term retention as much anymore. I think it has some connotations that people aren't comfortable with. So this term engagement, I think, has become more commonplace. And I think as trials become more complex and often sort of roll in several different trial designs into one, it's about giving good information simplistically and in a very timely manner. And that could be... that could be just content delivered to a mobile phone. It could be video-led for certain types of drug administrations. It could even be sort of informed consent services to whether they actually understand what they need to do and how often for and how long. And we've seen some real adaptations there as well. I think that's the main area where it's having an impact right now. Although having said that, certainly for us as a business, again, I can only speak personally, within the past 12 months, our e-diary or e-pro or e-coa, whichever you prefer, business has doubled. And that seems to be a trend where we're seeing people move away from the traditional handheld technologies and looking to see, well, what could we put on potentially the patient's own device, and this whole bring your own mobile, bring your own device concept into clinical programs. The seeds of that are starting in late phase trials where there are less less stringent regulations, I suppose. That's probably not the right term, but less sort of control requirements around the questionnaires we're presenting on patients' mobile phones. But now as the technology has evolved and as our capabilities have increased, we're seeing that trend now pushing back into the phase two and phase three space as well. But I suppose as an open gambit, that's probably where we see it. But obviously really interested to hear your guys' opinions as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of insight there. And I would throw out, by the way, just to build on one observation you made, that you know, I wouldn't look at patient engagement and patient retention as purely synonymous. I think that, to me, patient retention is an outcome that people want to achieve. It's getting people to come back to the clinic. But patient engagement, to me, is almost more of a mindset. It's that they actually want to come back to the clinic rather than that they're being, you know, dragged back to the clinic by whatever means possible, that they actually feel engaged as part of the study, invested in the outcome, that they want the study to work. And by that, what I mean, they don't want just the medicine to work. They want the trial to reach its successful conclusion because they have a vested interest in that. I mean, that was a lot of the motivation for us around things like the Blue Button project that we're doing to try to get data back to patients, to try to engage them and have them feel more engaged in the study itself. But I want to dissect a little bit more about what you were speaking about and turn over to Abby. As we think about the current state of mobile and trials, I think that there's a lot that Tim just talked through that seems to me a lot of the opportunity in the very near term, a lot of the trends pointing in certain directions. But it certainly seems to me that the core of mobile today is still pretty heavily rooted in some legacy devices, using ePro on old PDA types of devices. Am I wrong there, Abby? Is the mainstream state of mobile more than that today?
When I think about mobile, I think of kind of two different areas. One is the apps, mobile apps, and the use of mobile apps to be able to message people, to engage people, to provide content. Or the other side is actual medical devices or using mobile devices to collect information and send reminders. I think as far as the devices are concerned, ePro and eDiary by far are the areas where I think they are well understood. There are a number of products out there. When a pharma company knows they want to use an e-diary, few different vendors that they can go and get bids from, and that there's proven models for what works and doesn't work. We've heard quite a bit about even how the alarms go off on e-diaries and the reminders for patients and what bothers patients or helps them, how study coordinators feel about these devices, what instruments are best used in ePro and which ones may be too long or they don't work as well and better maybe even on paper. So I think you're right. Those are more common. Those are used. As far as in addition to that, when I think about clinical trials today, I think that their mobile apps and even BYOD is largely underutilized. So even though there are more than 200 current mobile apps that have been developed by pharmaceutical manufacturers, they're largely used on the commercial space with drug and disease information and health management. But they really have not been used in a big way or even more than pilots in the clinical development side. So just as it took us a few years to move to the, you know, from paper to ePro and paper diaries to e-diaries, I'm seeing that sort of slow comfort level in moving over to allowing patients to use their own phones or iPads or even giving them some other kind of medical device like a wireless glucometer to use. One thing that is interesting I want to add is I was over at the mHealth Summit yesterday walking the vendor floor. What I thought was really interesting, there are a lot of devices and blood pressure cuffs and wireless scales and glucometers and some interesting things that people were showing. But in large part, what was really interesting is when you ask people about mobile, it's texting. That's what they're doing. Hmm. And I was amazed that I thought we kind of got so beyond texting. I was amazed at how many companies that's what they were talking about, whether it was appointment reminders or drug, you know, reminders, reminding patients to take their drug, or texting for doctors to use with their patients in just their care and follow-up. So that surprised me a bit. I think that's being used for patient retention now in trials, but I thought it was going to be a lot further along on the commercial side than it was.
Abby, is that an artifact of, in the past, the mHealth Summit had a very heavy global health angle to it. Do you think that that's sort of a driver of the text sort of scene that you're seeing, or is it really just, folks in healthcare are all sort of just catching up in terms of using some of these more sophisticated mobile approaches?
I think it's probably a combination, but I do think that in general in healthcare, we're not as far along as maybe some other areas. So I think about the first one that comes to mind that's a comparable, highly regulated area is banking. You know, we all used to go into a bank, and then we started doing internet banking, and now, you know, I have my bank's mobile app, and I never go into the bank anymore, and I take photos of any checks that I need deposited. And I'm very comfortable with that, even though I'm talking about extremely secure private financial information. And so I think that even though it's a highly regulated area, in the financial area, they've seemed to have gone pretty far, wherein we're dealing with healthcare and PHI. I think that there's still a lot that we're kind of slow to adopt because of some of the security and regulatory concerns.
So, Tim, let's go back to this bring your own mobile theme, because I can't agree with you more. I think it's kind of crazy that we're still so locked into procuring and distributing these legacy devices, training patients on how to use them, having them carry a redundant device around, and all the extra costs and overhead that's associated there. What's holding us back? Abby gave a great analogy to the financial sector. I can do these awesome transactions on my own mobile device for that industry, which is highly regulated. What do we need to have happen for bring your own mobile to really reach mainstream for ePro?
Yeah, that's a question I've considered a lot over the years, as you can imagine. I think Abby touched on it as well, actually. At some point, I will return to a comment on the texting. Actually, I think that's very interesting, actually. But on the conversion, or rather, moving from provisioned device to bring your own device, I think a lot of it is down to, as Abby said perfectly there, the comfort factor. And PDAs have been around for a long time in the sort of clinical trial process, and the companies that are offering them now have got a business model that works. It's reliable. It's been through the sort of clinical trial process. It's been the data collected from them has been submitted to the FDA, and licenses have been granted on the back of that. So therefore, there's a feel-good factor there. I think people recognize there are pros and cons to that kind of approach. But there's no denying that if they submit data through to the FDA in that way, it'll be approved. Now, there's nothing anywhere within the regulations that the FDA have submitted about eCOA and ePro saying you can't use a mobile phone device. Obviously, you just have to ensure the consistency of the questionnaire in terms of, you know, whether it's psychometric sort of qualities have been adjusted or have to be changed to move on to different mobile platforms. And that's a challenge, you know. We're in the fortunate position where we have the technology where we can actually work out what device a patient has and then work out whether that would be valid for a particular questionnaire or not. But for a very conservative industry like ours, and I know that's always put up as an excuse, and I hate doing it myself, but I think it does stand. This is all pretty new stuff, and you're right, Abby. Obviously, you know, in banking and in lots of other very regulated industries, you know, if we can now use our mobile phones on our airplanes at 30,000 feet, whereas a year ago we couldn't because it was too dangerous. Well, the mobiles haven't changed. Why can we now? So why can't we do this in clinical trials? Well, I think it is a lot to do with fear over what the regulators will think without actually asking them, and also not wanting to ask them necessarily, not wanting to be the first. I think it's just like any adoption curve, whether it was, you know, EDC, whether it was original ePro, and it'll be the same with mobile adoption as well. It'll just be one of those things that we see a few coming through, and we've now push some data through to the FDA and it's been approved as a result. It'll just be a matter of building and building and building and going from there.
Yeah, you know, I know there's that the theme of a bit of inertia. People get comfortable with what's worked in the past, but, you know, in this day and age, we're in such a cost-constrained environment that people, you know, it seems are also, you know, increasingly receptive if something has some precedent, and as you said, you're getting data through to the FDA, while at the same time improving cost and convenience. So hopefully those trends will continue in that direction. I think you mentioned, though, that you had some other thoughts as well on that theme of text that Abby mentioned seeing at the summit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's true, isn't it? We all sort of think about apps because a lot of us are have a smartphone these days. I think the reason that texting is still popular is that although smartphone ownership is increasing dramatically, almost in a false economy way, I suppose, in some ways, because to try and go and buy a regular cell phone these days is actually pretty hard. You know, you can get a really smartphone or a not-so-smartphone, but they're always smart to an element of degree these days. You know, most devices don't have a keypad anymore. They have a touchscreen. But that's not the case everywhere in the world, and I think that's why texting continues to be very popular. You know, we still do a lot of it, especially in emerging market work, because it doesn't matter what device they have, it doesn't matter whether they're monthly subscription or prepay, you can get a message through to them, and they will receive that message, and it'll be received in their local language, and it won't require any other additional stuff they need to download to that particular device. There's no denying that that is often the path of least resistance. So I think that's why texting continues and is still an important part of it, because much as we'd like all of our patients to have you know, an app that's linked to a specific clinical program, and then we would just send in-app reminders through to that specific to, you know, when they walk through the clinic door, they would check in, and then they'd sit down, take a seat, and then they'd be taken to the next room. That's exactly how we perhaps, as innovators within the clinical trial space, see us participating in the clinical trial. But then I think sometimes we need to sort of distance ourselves and go, okay, well, what's happening down at the sort of grassroots level? What's happening in Argentina and what's happening in the Czech Republic? And what's the healthcare situation like and what's the provision like in that space? It's probably going to be much more different than we'd anticipate. So I think that's why the whole texting thing is still, it's still here, and I see it still sticking around all the time.
So I do agree that, you know, I look at myself and my own preferences, and I know I cannot extrapolate those onto the mainstream. I've got a Misfit Shine and a Fitbit Force. I've got my health data from all of my providers electronically because I want that, and I know that that does not reflect the majority of patients. I do think the trends point in that direction, but, you know, it won't be the case for all. Abby, when you think about an app for clinical trial use, do you think you need to go multi-platform? Do you have to developed so that you're able to service both the texters as well as the smartphone app users?
Well, I definitely think that if you're thinking of developing an app, then you need to develop an app that's available on all the main, you know, smartphone products, you know, iOS and Android, and so that's obviously important. I don't think there's a need to worry about designing any kind of texting program, whether it's for appointment reminders or diary reminders or drug reminders that need to. You need to worry about the device that your patients are using nowadays, as Tim indicated. But as far as an app, I would think about, you know, what is popular. You know, it's so funny. Here in the U.S., we talk a lot about iPhones. But if you look at use of the different smartphones in different countries, Samsung is bigger in some countries, and Android's much bigger and outside the U.S. And so you really need to think about where your clinical trial is, what countries you're in, where your sites are, and what your patient population is, and what your patient population may be using. Is it an older population? Is it an app that they'd be interested in? Would they even access it? Is it a population that downloads apps? Is it more of an underserved population that may or may not be interested in downloading an app or have health literacy issues? And so you want it to be more graphical and interactive video in your app. I've seen some really interesting things lately. When I think about what would be really great for using apps, I'm really excited about the opportunity around gamification and the ability to make gamification be a mechanism to improve patient engagement and patient retention. I've seen some wonderful examples for pediatric studies, in which patients have to remain in the study for 2-3 years, and by providing a gamification platform and some kind of gaming for the patient, it really makes them part of the study. They can have more of a community with other patients. You don't have to worry about, you know, identification. They can have sort of a username, but there's a real opportunity around that, and that's something I'm particularly excited about. And so, you know, when you ask for, you know, thinking about an app, there's some real exciting areas in gaming and really thinking about patient retention in order to be sort of the first way in and not worry about the PHI side or data going inside, but just having some tools to make patients more engaged in the trial that they're already signed up for.
That's great. You know, the data from Pew, their last survey on mobile use in the United States, iPhone was about 25% of smartphones and Android was 28%. So you're spot on with the assumption that we all get excited about our iPhones, but in reality, simply putting something out on an iPhone doesn't mean you're hardly saturating the smartphone market. So I'm curious, for both of you, do you see anyone, without naming names, do you see anyone who's really doing it right that, you know, is using mobile in a very clever and novel way to engage patients in their clinical trials today? Abby, you want to maybe take that first?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if I'm seeing anything that's really novel. I haven't looked at a lot of the different apps and devices that are out there in the different clinical trials. I've seen some demos of some of the different games that are being used by a couple companies. In almost every instance lately, it seems as though they're being piloted still and they're in a pilot mode. I definitely think we're beyond, like I said, texting. I think there are some companies, I've seen some of their products lately that are going to be coming out that have some interesting apps to help support sites with e-consent and help support sites with reminders and other tools like that.
Thanks.
I'm not sure of anything specific that, you know, is really kind of mind-blowing right now that I've been seeing.
Sure. Tim, anything from your vantage point? No need to name names, but anybody that you're seeing that's doing something that's really standing out or remarkable in terms of how they're approaching mobile for their clinical trials?
Yeah, I think there's some quite interesting things going on in certain therapy areas, actually, where the approach a couple of customers have used is to sort of think, well, rather than trying to, well, we've just got to do something on mobile, so let's just do a pilot and then just we'll sort of retreat when it doesn't quite work through. So, well, what can't we do? Well, you know, when we get a trial design, go, how on earth are we going to deliver this? Well, we can't. The traditional model just doesn't work at all. We know it doesn't, and it would be a nightmare. So what could we do with mobile? And then applying it in that particular way. So there's been quite a lot of activity in the vaccines area that we've been fortunate to be involved in, and also heard of other initiatives as well, where we're really there applying mobile technology for, I suppose, surveillance studies. So, for example, if you look out, as I look outside, it's snowing. We're in the flu season right now, so a lot of vaccine programs are designed around influenza, and often with this kind of approach is you recruit a lot of patients, and then you inoculate them, and then you send them home, and you're looking for symptoms of flu. And the traditional model would be the poor study nurse would have to call them up and say, you know, have you checked your temperature? What is it? Have you gotten the sniffles? You know, have you got a runny nose? Have you got a headache? And then if they did, get them in, do the mouth swab, and then send them home again. It used to cost a fortune, really expensive, really inefficient. The patient wouldn't answer the phone because they'd be involved in being at work or whatever, and the nurse would forget, not intentionally, but just other things would get in the way. You can do some really smart stuff on mobiles here where you just, and then, again, it being a global service, sending a text out, sending an email out. Have you had any symptoms? Yes or no. If no, nothing happens. If yes, another series of questions is sent. If that hits the algorithm, automatic call out to the patient, get them into the clinic and get the swab done. That is a really interesting way, I think, of approaching it. It's a mix of surveillance. It's a mixture of sort of ECOA to a certain extent, but it's on anybody's device because there isn't sort of it isn't a psychometric questionnaire, but it is patient-reported outcome data. I've seen a couple of those now. I think they're really interesting because they're huge, so they're like 8,000, 9,000, 10,000, 12,000 patients sample studies, very fast recruitment, so it needs to work, so there's no time for sort of having to provision devices and stuff. And I think that sort of nimbleness and the demands of that type of therapy area, that's where the innovation has come from. So I think that's a really interesting area. And then the other elements are more on the emerging market stuff, where they're looking at how to essentially run clinical trials more cost-effectively. To your point right at the beginning of the call, actually, Craig, about sort of, you know, economics being so tight in clinical research now, if they're looking to launch products in emerging markets that may well be old products from the established markets but new in developing, still need to do a local study, a local registry study, we'd have probably called it. Doing it at the hospitals doesn't necessarily work for the target demographic. So therefore, could you do it at pharmacies? And we've seen a lot of sort of pharmacy outreach programs where you don't want to give out a laptop, but maybe you can give a smartphone to each pharmacy. And as the patient is waiting to get his prescription, they can complete a short questionnaire on the smartphone, give it back, and you can even tie it into blood glucose and monitoring devices that are installed in there as well, and run a very light, very nimble clinical trial program. So those are the sort of two areas at the moment that strike me as being quite exciting.
So you hit on a couple of interesting points there for sure. You know, at that last DPharm meeting back in September, one of the big themes that a lot of people were up there talking about was about running studies in simple, accessible ways for patients, a lot of which did take advantage of both mobile as well as point of care, diagnostics, and other sensors. Many of them, referenced, for instance, the study that we did together, the remote trial, but, you know, really built on that with approaches that Novartis has been taking with Walgreens as an example, among others, to try to improve that access and convenience. I think one of the consistent themes that you hear when people are thinking about that future state is around the use of other types of sensors, that we have our mobile devices to capture some good self-reported data, but what other data are we going to be able to get directly from the patient going forward? What other data can we source from sensors? And how are we going to incorporate those either in our development programs or potentially even into how we're commercializing that asset. Tim, I'm not sure if you're are you guys seeing a lot of programs right now that are starting to touch on incorporating sensors in their studies? And then, Abby, we'll wrap up with your thoughts there.
Sure. Yeah, we are actually. It's still being driven predominantly, as you would expect, by the respiratory franchises, I suppose, where we're linking our platform and receiving data from, you know, Bluetooth-enabled spirometers. And now, actually, a really interesting area, I think, for us is, which originally came from some work we're doing on the commercial side, is where it's not just a Bluetooth-enabled spirometer, but there's also Bluetooth-enabled medication sort of devices, so almost like Bluetooth-enabled inhalers. So if a patient is having to use their rescue medication, for example, they hit the pump, they press the puffer, it then registers that. So we can then analyze that and trend that and say, well, is that patient exacerbating? Do we need to intervene? Does the study nurse need to get an alert? So that's certainly something that we're seeing more and more of. And obviously with just the amount of glucose monitors that are available now as well and so much more that they can do, we've done a lot there as well. So, yes, I think that is, as you said, bringing together the subjective of the patient's view of how they're doing and the objective of how they really are doing, I think is a very powerful area. And we've been fortunate to take some of our learnings from our commercial stuff and then offer that to the clinical teams, often, you know, usually within the same company, and say, well, why couldn't you do this here? And that's helping establish that continuum of technology where, you know, eventually I always imagined that when you're getting a prescription, you're essentially enrolling yourself into a long-term, real-world clinical trial. So, yeah, I think that's a key trend that we're seeing coming through.
Well, certainly, you know, when you've got the self-reported data coming in on the patient's own device and sensors that are, you know, used in both research and by consumers who want to self-track, that continuation of capturing data outside of the trial becomes a very potential future. Abby, I'm curious, you know, you work in an interesting organization from the UBC side, executing on a lot of these programs, but also as a part of Express Scripts, having that payer vantage point and access as well. How do you see that future state of sensors in research studies and then potentially carrying over into how those assets are ultimately registered and reimbursed?
I'm glad you brought up Express Scripts because it's been having a parent company that is a PBM and has not only access to a nice large client base of employers and health plans, but also has, you know, a very substantial specialty pharmacy and home delivery pharmacy, which gives us an opportunity and allows us to try different things out and packaging out through the pharmacy. And we love being in having an opportunity to work with pharma to try out a number of the sensors and devices in a real-world setting, like the pharmacy, maybe even set it up as a study so that we can collect data and be able to use that information and that data to be able to bring it back to the Express Scripts client base to see if this would be of interest and where they see the biggest need in helping support their members. So we've been doing some pilots and running some initiatives looking at different, like GloCap, the MEMS caps, and other devices that can be used for helping patients remember to take their meds, to monitor when they take their meds, and help them, you know, remember when they need to be getting refills. And that's been a really interesting experiment and an opportunity for us to be able to collect that data. We are really interested in applying these types of devices, and we're seeing more and more interest in applying these types of sensors and monitoring devices in clinical trials, not just because sponsors want to, you know, help better track and make sure patients are taking their medications in the trials, but they are interested in seeing if they're used in this setting. Is this something that could apply in the real world once the drug is on the market and it's been launched? How do patients feel about them? Are they using them? Is it improving adherence? And so we've been looking at not just the sensors to do that and some of those types of devices that are with the drug in the bottle, but now we're starting to look at pill dispensers that where patients can put a variety of pills in a case, a product like a Medic Pen, where they can put multiple drugs in for, say, a week's worth of their medication, and they can get reminders on different drugs at different time points to be able to see how that changes a patient's adherence and their engagement. And we'd really love to apply some of those tools that we're doing now in the commercial setting and with our parent company in the clinical trial setting. And we're very interested in encouraging, we're very supportive of having our clients that are designing trials in areas of anywhere under metabolic syndrome, obesity, diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol, areas where we're really encouraging increased diet and exercise to also bring in other devices like Fitbit or a Jawbone or a Pebble and incorporating some of that added patient data into their trial designs. And I think it's something that could get patients having fun with it. They take a bigger part in it. It's another data point that can maybe tell a bigger story and help look at the total outcomes for the patient when they're in the study. And it's also something that can be quite fun for the patient and help with, again, with engagement. So we're looking at those devices to also try in a pilot mode through in conjunction with Express Scripts as well.
Wow. You know, I love this space. There's so much, you know, when we think about digital from social and mobile and health information technology, this mobile vertical alone has so much exciting progress. You guys have helped to talk through that range from getting us from legacy devices for ePro only through to bring your own mobile to the spirit of using apps, whether it's for e-consent or all the way through for other aspects of patient engagement, and how that can carry over and start to incorporate other devices and sensors for additional data from the patient and potentially even chart new ways that those medicines can demonstrate meaningful outcomes to patients in the clinic. So it's a great space to spend some time talking to you. Tim Davis, Exco In Touch, and Abby Steele from UBC, thanks so much for your time today.
Pleasure. Good to talk.
Thanks, everyone. Abby, Tim, and Craig, a great show. And Tim, I'll be thinking of your quote all day, that is, great ideas always start in the pub. So whether they be a pub or anywhere else, I think we wouldn't have any of this unless we all spend more time brainstorming and creating. So nice show. Thanks, everyone.
No problem.
Sure. Thanks, Sal.
Thanks.